This paid program may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. Advances in biomedical research seek to enhance health, lengthen life, and reduce the burdens of illness and disability. The National Institutes of Health, NIH, plays a central role in making this all happen. Its basic research and translational advances have prompted a revolution in the diagnosis, treatment, and prevention of diseases. As a result, U.S. life expectancy has increased dramatically over the past century and still continues to improve. Not only are people living longer, they are living healthier lives. However, science is not a 100-yard dash. It's a marathon. A marathon run by a relay team that includes researchers, patients, industry experts, lawmakers, and the public. This is a remarkable time of discovery, and the opportunities in science and medicine are at once exciting and urgent. How has basic research prompted a revolution in the diagnosis, treatment, and prevention of diseases? What is NIH doing to advance biomedical research to enhance human life and health? And how does the investment in such research increase the country's global competitiveness? We'll explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, Dr. Francis Collins, Director of the National Institutes of Health. Dr. Collins, welcome to the show. It's terrific to have you.
It's wonderful to be with you.
Dr. Collins, before we delve into specific initiatives, perhaps you can provide us with a brief overview of the history and mission of the National Institutes of Health. When was it created and what's its mission to date?
We are celebrating our 125th anniversary. NIH, its original form, which was a hospital particularly focused on mariners who had a lot of problems with tuberculosis, founded in 1887. At that point, it was in Staten Island. It gradually moved to Washington and ultimately to Bethesda, and has been really our nation's major investment in biomedical research now for many decades, the largest such institution in the world.
So with such an interesting mission, could you give us a sense of the scale of operation within the organization? How is it organized, the size of its budget, number of employees?
There are about 17,000 full-time employees plus contractors that work for the National Institutes of Health, a wide variety of skill sets. Many of them are distinguished scientists with doctoral degrees, but lots of other people work on the campus in Bethesda and in the other units that we operate, including one of our institutes in North Carolina, some other activities in Baltimore, and others in Montana. So we are scattered a bit, but the main focus is on our campus right up here on Wisconsin Avenue in Bethesda, Maryland.
Great. I'd like to get a sense of the composition of your research portfolio. What percent of research is conducted in-house versus awarded through NIH's competitive grants program?
So about 11% of the budget is devoted to research in what we call our intramural program. And those are both basic and clinical studies done on our facilities, including the main one here in Bethesda. And that includes the largest research hospital in the world, the Clinical Center of NIH, 240 beds, all utilized for clinical protocols. Patients come here from all over the country, all over the world, to be part of these clinical research studies. The remainder of our budget primarily goes out in grants to our nation's finest institutions and some outside the country as well. Investigators send us their best ideas. They're reviewed in a two-level peer review system, which is very rigorous. And the ones that are judged most meritorious then get supported. So 85% of our budget goes out in grant awards to those investigators. And by the way, our overall budget this year is about $30.8 billion. So it's a very substantial amount of taxpayers' money for which we are grateful and feel very responsible.
So, Doctor, you've done a wonderful job of setting the context and giving us a sense of what NIH actually does and how it does it. I'd like to focus a little bit more on your specific responsibilities as the director of NIH. Would you tell us more about your duties and the areas under your purview?
It's an amazing job, and no day is like any other. I am responsible for standing at the helm of this remarkable ship of discovery and trying to see if it can be steered in the direction that is going to have the greatest benefit to the public. So that means I oversee the actions of 27 institutes and centers which make up the NIH, each of which is led by a distinguished scientist who is a director of one of those institutes. I'm particularly responsible for looking out for opportunities where we can do things in a collaborative way across institutes so that, for instance, if there's a problem with obesity research, can we get all the institutes to work together on that? And also for looking at opportunities to collaborate outside of NIH with other government agencies like FDA or CMS or CDC and with other foundations or with industry. I spend a lot of my time trying to make sure, especially in this tight budget climate, that we're making the most of those collaborations.
So, Dr. Collins, how does your effort support the overall mission of HHS?
HHS is, of course, the department within the U.S. government responsible for health and human services, and NIH is the strongest component of that, focused on medical research to try to identify new ways to diagnose, to prevent, and to treat disease, and to try to increase the likelihood that all of us will live long and healthy lives and not have those shortened or diminished by chronic disease. That's a very large responsibility, but we feel that if you look historically, our contributions to the improvement of human health in America have really been quite dramatic.
Dr. Collins, regarding your responsibilities and duties, you've laid out, you have an expansive portfolio, a fairly large budget. What are the top three challenges you face in your position? How have you sought to address those challenges?
It comes in three different categories. First, and maybe most important, is science. Where are the scientific opportunities? Science is moving very fast right now. We're able to do things that I wouldn't have dreamed 10 years ago would be possible in my lifetime, working with DNA sequencing, working with stem cells, coming up with ways to do imaging of the brain and people who are alive and thinking, and we're watching what happens when they do various tasks. Those are just amazing opportunities. And it is very much part of my job to be sure that we're pushing the envelope as hard as we can. So that's the top challenge. Connected to that is the need to be sure that we are training and retaining the best and brightest of our potential most important resource, the scientific researchers themselves. How do we make sure that we're identifying pathways so that young scientists can get the training they need and become highly productive, successful, creative, have careers that are both inspiring to us and to them. And third, and without which nothing else can happen, we need the resources to support all of this. And at a time where anything that the government is supporting has come into question because of our nation's fiscal challenges, I spend a lot of my time simply explaining why a dollar invested in biomedical research is an extremely good use of taxpayers' dollars, both in terms of what it can do for human health and actually how it stimulates our economy.
Dr. Collins, I'd like to learn more about yourself. You are a recognized physician geneticist and a leader of the International Human Genome Project. Could you tell us a little bit about your career path for our listeners? How did you begin your career and what brought you to your current leadership role?
I think it'd be fair to say my career is pretty nonlinear, and certainly as a kid growing up on a small farm in the Shenandoah Valley, a farm that lacked indoor plumbing, you would not have necessarily encountered me as somebody who is going to be on this pathway, and I would have not believed it if you had suggested that. I got interested in science as a high school student, initially with the science of chemistry, and went on to get a PhD in physical chemistry before I realized that biology was calling and medicine was calling. So then I went to medical school, got to the point of realizing that genetics was really the thing that I found most inspiring and most exciting, and went from that to a university position, University of Michigan, and then was asked to come here to NIH in 1993 to direct the Human Genome Project, which has just barely gotten started at that point. That was a tough sell for me, I must say. One thing my mother said was, whatever you do, don't work for the federal government. And here I was being asked to do just that. But it's been phenomenal to have a chance to be surrounded by such amazing talent and to lead that effort, which read out for the very first time all of the letters of the Human DNA Instruction Book, pretty historic undertaking. Who would have dreamed that could happen to a kid growing up on that farm in the Shenandoah Valley? And now to be back at NIH, I took a year off in between and then got called back to be the NIH director. Just an exhilarating opportunity to try to encourage the best and brightest scientists to do the greatest research you could imagine.
That's a compelling story, and I'd like to get a sense of, from your experience, what are the characteristics of an effective leader, and more particularly, given your work leading the Genome Project, what lessons did you learn as the director that have informed your current efforts?
I'm sure I made a lot of mistakes, and I hope I learned from them, because I came to the job of leading the Genome Project with very little experience running anything much larger than my own research lab. But along the way, I learned one of the things you want to do is surround yourself with the smartest people, ideally people even smarter than you are, and then listen to them very carefully. And also surround yourself with people who are willing to tell you when you're about to do something that's not a good idea. You want people who are not afraid to speak the truth to the leader. And that has been enormously helpful. And to let everybody know that that is the expectation, that if you see something that Dr. Collins is about to do that you think is a mistake, you better speak up. I will never come down on you for that. But if you tell me later that you knew it and you didn't tell me, well, that'll be a problem. So, yeah, the ability to have that kind of a team is just critical. And, of course, any leader wants to be involved in a project where the mission is compelling. And where you can have a vision about where you want to go that is ambitious and audacious, and that you can get other people to share that. And I've been fortunate that the jobs I've had have had that quality so that it is possible to bring people to the table and get them pretty inspired about, you know, putting some of their own sort of personal considerations to the side, because the shared goal is so important. We're all going to put our shoulders to the wheel together.
How has basic research prompted a revolution in the diagnosis, treatment, and prevention of diseases? We will ask Dr. Francis Collins, Director of the National Institutes of Health, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. How can we enhance national competitiveness? What about getting big things done in government? And how can government better manage risks and use resources more wisely? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. Hear from Comptroller General Gene Dodaro, SSA Commissioner Michael Astrew, Coast Guard Commandant Admiral Robert Papp, NGA Director Tish Long, and Aaron Connaughton on the Air Force's strategic vision. All of this and so much more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Dr. Francis Collins, Director of the National Institutes of Health. Dr. Collins, NIH is the leading supporter of biomedical research in the world. Would you tell us more about your strategic vision for NIH, and how do the five themes or areas of exceptional opportunity factor into this vision?
When I was asked to come and lead this effort, I spent some time thinking hard about where the areas were that were most ripe for this kind of emphasis, and talked to a lot of other scientists whose opinions I value, and came up with these five themes that seemed exceptionally ready for additional emphasis. They're pretty broad. They cover a lot of what NIH is able to do. One of those is to push the basic science, but inform it by technology, because technology is really advancing in many ways. And perhaps in the past, biologists tended to think of technology as a secondary area of emphasis. These days, it drives so much of what we can do that it deserves its own kind of push. Secondly, we wanted to be sure that opportunities to take basic science and bring it into clinical applications could be speeded up, emphasized, nurtured, encouraged in new ways, what you'd call translational science. Third, because we were at that point when I first came to NIH in the midst of a national discussion about how we're going to revise our own approach to healthcare. NIH, while we're not part of the healthcare delivery system, we are responsible for generating the evidence about what works and what doesn't work. So that also seemed to be a very important theme to emphasize. How could we provide the rigorous research that would enable patients and physicians to know what kind of interventions are going to be available and what's going to help them? Fourth, and maybe this is the one that surprised some people, was global health. I think we no longer live in a world where we can afford to think about the health of the United States in isolation from what's going on elsewhere. All those infectious diseases that pay no attention to country borders are just one example of that. And it's more than that now, with all of the things that are happening in terms of trends in chronic diseases, which cross boundaries as well. And there's lots of opportunities in global health to try to pursue that more vigorously, and lots of young scientists who are interested in that area. So that was the fourth theme. And then finally, and the most critical resource of all, is to support the researchers that are going to be doing the work. And to be sure, we have set up a system that recruits the best and the brightest to come and join us from whatever group they represent, and to provide them with a kind of career trajectory that they can feel is worth investing in. Because if we don't have that talent, none of the rest of this will happen.
So, Doctor, before we get into each one of these themes a little bit more, I'd like for you to highlight some of today's major scientific and health challenges. Would you elaborate on these challenges? And could you possibly highlight some of the factors that may have contributed to the rise of such challenges?
Sure. Well, first of all, we've made enormous progress in terms of extending longevity in the U.S., now standing at about age 79, whereas in 1900, the average survival was in your 40s. So enormous progress based on the results of research. Look at deaths from heart attack and stroke, which have dropped by 60 or 70% in just the last 40 years, is another example of how we've advanced because of medical research. But of course, that has presented us with additional challenges right now. For instance, with the aging of the population, Alzheimer's disease emerges as a very significant concern, and one where we believe right now there's some exceptional scientific opportunity as well. The obesity crisis. When you look at what's happened to our country, where now 69% of adults are overweight or obese, just a frightening number, and it's happened relatively quickly over the last 30 years. All the consequences that carries in terms of diabetes and many other complications are likely to take away many of the gains that have been obtained previously in terms of human health. And we urgently need to come up with better ways to give people the tools they need to avoid that future outcome of all of us being overweight. Many other areas of great opportunity but challenge. Cancer, certainly beginning to yield up a lot of its secrets, but we need to move as fast as we can to try to get those cancer death rates down, because there's still far too many people who are stricken with cancers like pancreatic cancer, for instance, or brain cancer, where we don't have the kind of interventions that are as successful as we would like. Those are just a few. I could also point to childhood problems like autism, which is a national concern, and well, it should be given the increasing frequency, and we don't quite understand why that is. I could point to our increasing need to be sure that we're taking advantage of what we know works, like managing hypertension, for instance, but we have still a better need to understand how to implement effective strategies in the real world, and that's another area of priority.
Well, Dr. Collins, what is basic research and how does it differ from applied or translational research? And what are you doing, more importantly, to bridge these aspects of scientific exploration?
NIH spends about 53% of its budget on basic research, and that would be defined as research on some aspect of biological processes that does not have an immediate implication or application to a disease. But you have to understand how life works at the most fundamental level before you can really understand what disease is all about. So this is the foundation of everything we do. And over the course of many decades, the basic science research, which has led to no less than 135 Nobel Prizes for NIH-funded grantees, is the way in which we've often then gotten to the next level of understanding about a biological process, and that in turn has led to insights about disease, which are now making big differences clinically. if we want to continue to see those medical advances going forward 10, 20, 30 years from now, we need to be doing the basic science now that is going to provide that foundation.
Dr. Collins, you noted that basic discovery and the development of therapies go hand in hand at NIH, and that these two types of research have and always will exist together in a continuum. Would you highlight just a few areas in which basic research advances are opening up new translational opportunities?
Well, for instance, basic science trying to understand at the fundamental level what are the causes of various rare diseases. Rare diseases collectively affect about 26 million Americans, and there are about 7,000 of these rare diseases. In the space of just the last 10 years, we've uncovered, using basic science strategies, the molecular basis of about 4,700 of those diseases. Just breathtaking, the rate at which this insight has been coming forward. Of course, that's useful in terms of getting a grasp on what the diseases are all about, but what you really want is to translate that into an intervention. Only about 250 of those diseases currently have any treatment at all. By having now made those basic discoveries, we're poised to be able to translate that into action. And that is, in fact, a major focus of a new center at NIH, the National Center for Advancing Translational Sciences. There are a number of steps that you want to follow once you understand the molecular basis of a disease. They're complicated, they're failure-prone, they're risky. But we know increasingly how to do that. And that's a great example of how, at the present time, the basic science informs the translation. I should say, this is also a virtuous circle, that when you make an observation at the basic level that leads you to clinical insight, sometimes when you try this out clinically, you learn something about the basics as well, and you go around that virtuous circle to your benefit over and over again.
Well, Dr. Collins, could you give us a sense of the complex process you just alluded to? What are some of the key steps so our listeners understand a little bit more?
Sure. Maybe I'll use an example, and I'll pick an example actually from my own research lab because I continue to run a lab here at NIH. We're studying the rarest form of premature aging, a condition called progeria, which affects children who age at about 7 times the normal rate and sadly usually die by age 12 or 13 from heart attacks or strokes. And at that point, they look like little old people who have aged very rapidly. Basic science led us to discover the cause of that 9 years ago. But now following up on that, additional basic science helped us understand why a single DNA letter out of 3 billion that was misspelled was capable of causing this multi-system disease and suggested something we could do about it. There are now 28 kids with progeria. It's such a rare disease, it's hard to find more than that, who've been on a clinical trial for 4 years with a drug that we believe has all the right properties to help them. And we're watching closely to see how that goes with some encouraging signs. That drug was actually developed not for progeria, but for cancer. But it turns out it has the right properties to affect the pathway that we know needs some tweaking for these kids with this disease. Along the way, we've learned things by studying the clinical disease of progeria that are teaching us interesting aspects of the normal process of aging, something that all of us, including you and I have in our future. So it's a great example of this basic to clinical back to basic.
So how do you see the balance between basic science and translational research evolving into the future?
I think we will continue at NIH to have about the same balance we do now, roughly 50-50 of basic and translational. I think I said basic is 53% right now. I don't imagine it changing much from that. We are at NIH the major supporter of basic biomedical research. The translational and clinical efforts, of course, do go on also in the private sector, and well, they should. And we work closely to be sure that what we do in that arena is complementary and not competitive with the private sector. But the private sector is not going to do the basic research that's not connected to a product. It's really NIH's job to do that. We take that very seriously. We don't intend to diminish that responsibility.
Dr. Collins, despite huge investments in biomedical science and technology, The number of new drugs approved per $1 billion of R&D research has been cut in half every 9 years since 1950. I found that fascinating. To tackle this problem, you propose the creation of the National Center for Advancing Translational Sciences, or NCATS. Would you elaborate on the mission of the center? What are some of the key ways it will enhance the development of drugs and diagnostics?
Well, you point out correctly that if you look at the efficiency of producing new drugs and getting them approved for general application, it's a very scary-looking series of trends. A recent publication, perhaps it's the one you're citing, looked at this. It almost looks as if there's some law of physics going on here where year after year, the productivity of the enterprise is dropping in a constant fashion. This is sort of the opposite of what you would expect, where a lot of dollars are going into this, a lot of new science has become possible. You would think we'd be getting better at this. In fact, the authors of that article, somewhat tongue-in-cheek, decided to name this with a name of a law, picking up on the Moore's Law for computers, which says things always get better. They called this Eroom's Law, which is Moore written backwards, to emphasize how backwards this whole scene is. So we've got a big problem here. We have all these diseases for which treatments are desperately needed. We have these fantastic explosion of insights on the basic science front about what causes these illnesses, and yet somehow things aren't getting through the pipeline. So NCATS, this National Center for Advancing Translational Sciences, was very much founded on the need to try to identify what are those systematic bottlenecks that cause this process to be so challenging. And it is. The average time it takes to go from a good idea about a new treatment to getting that drug approved is 14 years. The failure rate is well over 99%. Now, an engineer looking at a pipeline like that would say, come on, there must be something better you could do here to improve success and shorten the time. And that's what NCATS aims to do, to look systematically in a way that no single project focus would achieve. Where are the bottlenecks? Where are the things where we lose momentum, where time goes by more than it should, where failure rates are way too high? Could we take some of the new science that's coming forward in the last few years and really re-engineer that pipeline? That's what we're trying to do.
So, Doctor, as a follow-up, would you tell us more about your collaboration with the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, in advancing the field of regulatory science? How does the formation of the NIH-FDA Joint Leadership Council factor into such an effort?
It's very important. Peggy Hamburg and I, shortly after we were both appointed to our roles at FDA and NIH, formed this council and agreed that we would personally co-chair it. The idea being to try to identify, from both the agency's perspective, how could we move more quickly to get safe and effective treatments in the hands of patients, building on the science that's now possible. I'll just give you one example where we're working with FDA on a new approach to try to identify when you have a promising drug that you think might be the next big thing for cancer or diabetes, how do you know whether it's going to be safe? There comes that moment where you have to decide whether or not that drug can be given to the first human patient. Right now, the way we test that is to give that same drug to some small animals, some large animals at increasing doses. We look to see if there's any evidence of toxicity. And it's a system that's slow and expensive and not very reliable, unfortunately. Animals just aren't the same as we are. The new approach, which we're working on both with FDA and with the Department of Defense in their DARPA program, the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, is to load human cells representing various organ types onto a biochip and to wire them up with readouts that will tell you whether those cells are happy or not when a compound is shown to them. This will allow us to look at human liver, human heart, human kidney, human brain on a biochip in a fashion that we believe should be closer to the action in terms of predicting whether a drug is going to be safe or not, and should also be much faster and cheaper to utilize once the chip is developed. Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun to see how this goes, bringing together the engineering perspective of DARPA, NIH's biological expertise, FDA's intense interest in the regulatory aspects of this to be sure that it's going to hold up well and actually be reliable. And we might be able to completely re-engineer the way that that part of the drug pipeline is currently conducted to the benefit of everybody.
What is NIH doing to advance biomedical research to enhance human life and health? We will ask Dr. Francis Collins, director of NIH, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. The IBM Center for the Business of Government has recently published Governing to Win, Enhancing National Competitiveness Through New Policy and Operating Approaches, edited by Chuck Proe, which brings together insightful essays by leading thinkers and practitioners that offer a long-term strategy to improve national competitiveness. How can our nation better compete in today's global economy? And how can moving to an Enterprise USA approach in government enhance our national competitiveness? This book explores these questions and so much more. Governing to Win is available at bookstores, online booksellers, and from the publisher, RomanLittlefield.com. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Dr. Francis Collins, Director of the National Institutes of Health. So, Dr. Collins, you've alluded to some of these advances and some of these accomplishments that NIH research has achieved. I'd like to sort of highlight a little bit around chronic diseases, a healthy mind, infectious diseases, and maybe something around children's health and aging. What are some of the advances you see?
Well, let me pick a few specific examples. Chronic disease, I mentioned the epidemic of obesity and diabetes. What are we doing about that? There are some 60 million individuals who currently have what you call pre-diabetes who live in the United States. That is to say, they haven't been diagnosed with full-blown diabetes, but if you test their ability to handle sugar, glucose, they're clearly abnormal. And if nothing is done, the chances are that the majority of those individuals over time will tip over into full-blown diabetes with all of its complications. So you'd like to catch this at the pre-diabetes state and do something about it. Well, we now know how to do something about this based on NIH research. If those individuals are given an opportunity to get involved in a program of diet and exercise involving a coach, and that turns out to be crucial. You don't just send people away with a pamphlet. You actually put them in a position where they have encouragement, direct interaction with an expert who helps them figure out how to get into an exercise program, stick with it, and how to modify their diet just to lose 6 or 7% of their body weight. It's not like this enormously crash diet program. It turns out that will reduce that person's likelihood of going on to full-blown diabetes by 50 to 60%, and that's sustained over 10 years. So if we can implement this, which we're now trying to do in a collaborative effort with the CDC and the YMCA across the country, we could enormously reduce what is currently an epidemic of adult-onset diabetes, saving people all of those complications and saving our nation the costs of taking care of a diabetics, which is obviously an enormous part of our current escalation in medical costs. That's just an example. Other things, infectious diseases. Well, this is the year where the International AIDS Conference was held in Washington, D.C., and enormous achievements there in terms of taking what had been a fairly rapidly fatal disease in the 1980s to now turning this into a chronic illness managed by antiretroviral therapies so that somebody diagnosed as HIV positive now has a life expectancy of about age 70, which is just phenomenal to be able to say. And significant advances now in terms of the vaccines, which have been so frustrating to try to generate, but which are finally showing some promise, as well as other interventions that make us optimistic that we might, for the first time, be facing the possibility of an AIDS-free generation in the not-distant future. In children's health, well, certainly the efforts to understand the causes of autism come to mind, and we are learning a lot about that disease, although we need more information about how to intervene when that is diagnosed. The National Children's Study, which is going to get underway in the fairly near future, will follow 100,000 children all the way through pregnancy, delivery, and through their first 21 years of life. And that's going to teach us a lot about factors we don't know about yet. In terms of aging, The ability now to understand Alzheimer's disease at a much more detailed molecular level is giving us hopes that there will, in fact, be interventions for this disease that work, but probably there'll need to be interventions introduced as early as possible, not waiting until people already have far advanced symptoms. Just the same, I would say the whole field of Alzheimer's disease is energized in a way that has not happened in decades by the science that's happened, much of it just in the last few months.
Well, Dr. Collins, I'd like to switch gears a bit and talk about how technology in some sense is advancing or driving science. I think you can just look at the cost of the DNA sequencing to see this dynamic at work. The cost curve for sequencing has dropped precipitously, and I'd like to discuss that. What are the implications of a lower sequencing cost, and to what extent may it revolutionize how clinicians diagnose and treat diseases?
If you want to pick an area of technology that just takes your breath away in terms of the speed of its progress, it would be DNA sequencing. That first human genome sequence that I had the privilege of overseeing, the team that managed to pull this off, cost about $400 million when it was completed in 2003. You can now get your human genome sequenced for about $7,000. Think about that, $400 million down to $7,000 in the space of just about 9 years. And the cost continues to plummet. So we will, in the next 3 to 4 years, certainly achieve this goal that many people thought was a bit overly audacious, namely the $1,000 genome. But we're well on the way to achieving that. How will that change things? Well, it already is changing things in cancer, increasingly as part of research studies. And it won't be long before this finds its way into the management of cancer in general, is the desire to know in any given individual's cancer exactly what has gone wrong in those cancer cells that's causing them to grow faster than they're supposed to. Because cancer is a disease of the genome. And now we have the chance to look comprehensively, each individual at a time, in what's gone wrong there and what you might want to do about it. Because knowing that, you can then choose the right combination of targeted therapies that are not one size fits all, but are designed for that person's specific molecular signature. That's just one example. Certainly all of us in the next decade will probably have the chance to have our complete genome sequences placed into our medical record. That will give insights into what you might be at risk for in the future. It will give insights into, if you fall ill, what drug should be used for you and what dose, because individual differences can be predicted by a study of the DNA. So it is going to transform the way we approach many medical problems, but not overnight. There were some overly optimistic predictions that this was going to happen in the blink of an eye. It takes a lot of hard work, a lot of research, a lot of driving the cost down to make those things come true.
There's also some privacy concerns around genetic testing, and I'd like to switch gears on that. What are your thoughts around privacy concerns, and what needs to be done to the genetic testing infrastructure so that privacy issues are no longer a problem?
As the director of the Human Genome Project, one of my areas of focus was, in fact, on the ethical, legal, and social implications of these advances, and much work was done to try to anticipate what we would need to do about privacy and confidentiality. One of the big achievements of that focus was the passage and signing into law of the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, GINA, which now, as a law of the land in the United States, says that your DNA information cannot be used against you in health coverage or in employment. That was a big issue that was getting in the way of a lot of people's comfort level in terms of having information about their genomes determined, even though they might want the information for medical purposes. In terms of privacy, again, this fits pretty much into the whole question of privacy of the rest of your medical record. Are we going to have a system where DNA information as part of that medical record is protected in the same way as the rest of it? I think we're coming along reasonably well there. Of course, many people would say our whole ideas of privacy are gradually evolving. Certainly, people in the younger generation seem a lot less concerned about those issues, judging by ways in which they put very private information up on Facebook. I wouldn't advocate, however, that we take that as necessarily a guide to good behavior. I think the privacy issues are manageable, however.
Dr. Collins, much of the NIH research successes have created the opportunity for personalized medicine. What are some of the benefits of personalized medicine? And perhaps you could share with us some success stories in this area.
Sure. I'm thinking of a success story related to a pair of twins that I have learned about and met their parents. These twins born with what appeared to be a neurologic problem that defied clear explanation. At some point, they were called cerebral palsy. Then they were tried on various drug therapies for something that fit into the category of a dystonia condition. But gradually, these two, Noah and Alexis Beery, became more and more impaired, and particularly Alexis, the girl, these are fraternal twins, became more severely ill to the point where she was spending much time in the ER. I had some very close calls with near-death experiences, and her parents at wit's end finally sought out investigators, in this case at the Baylor College of Medicine in Texas, to see if there was anything else that could be done. The investigators decided, well, let's really make this personalized. Let's sequence the genomes of these two twins and their parents and see if we could uncover a cause. And in this case, they hit a home run. They found mutations in a particular enzyme that's responsible for producing normal levels of a neurotransmitter. And it made it clear that these two twins could not produce that neurotransmitter. But it was possible with a simple dietary change to supply that to them. Alexis, the twin who was near death about 3 years ago, is now running varsity track on her high school team. Just an amazing turnaround and the kind of success story you love to hear about. I could tell you about a few others of this sort, like Nick, a kid in Wisconsin who was near death from an inflammatory bowel disease condition that rarely strikes kids as young as he was, whose genome revealed a glitch in a gene on his X chromosome that suggested he might benefit from a stem cell transplant, which would never have been considered for his disease. The transplant was done. Nick, I gather, had a pretty good first grade year, is now having summer camp experiences, eating whatever he wants and doing just fine. So these things begin to appear, and it's exciting to see more and more of them.
So continuing on this thread of technology driving science, mobile devices have the potential to become powerful medical tools. But you also note that cool technology is not necessarily synonymous with good science or sound health practices. Would you elaborate on mHealth technologies and the potential benefits and issues associated with them?
I'm very excited about these because cell phones are now so ubiquitous, and the opportunity to use those for prevention purposes or monitoring chronic disease is very compelling. I volunteered myself for a clinical trial where my iPhone was connected up with a gadget that would send my EKG in real time across the country to a cardiologist in Los Angeles, who could then tell when I was excited because my heart rate would go up. Fortunately, I didn't have any other scary rhythms to report. But this is pretty amazing to imagine for somebody who does have a significant cardiac problem, where we've previously had to deal with very clunky ways of doing ambulatory monitoring and now could do this continuously with real-time transmission of the results to the physician. Another very exciting application is for diabetes monitoring. I've seen a pilot example of a small chip that's embedded under the skin at the wrist that is capable of continuously monitoring blood glucose without having to stick your finger every few hours. And it transmits the results to a gadget, which you wear like a watch. That, in turn, transmits this continuous tracing of your glucose to your care provider. If you want to get really good management of diabetes and know exactly where you are, this is where you'd like to have the technology take you. But I think we have to be sure we're not just carried away by the gee whiz aspects of these new gadgets. You have to also do the research to show that in the real world, that results in a better outcome. Otherwise, we're just fooling ourselves. And that's where I think NIH has a really important role to play with so-called mHealth, is to be sure that as these exciting new technologies emerge, they get put to the test to make sure they really benefit people in terms of their overall health status.
I want to continue on this this thread of benefit, and in particular, NIH's research and how it benefits the global competitiveness of the country. Could you elaborate on that?
It's very clear, if people look closely at the economic data, that medical research has been a major driver of American success, particularly in the last 20 or 30 years. It's also clear that America's leadership in biomedical research, which was unquestioned in the 1980s, is now being challenged substantially by accomplishments in other countries. And we should celebrate what those other countries are doing and the investments they're making, whether it's China or India or Brazil or Europe or the UK, all of whom are making very substantial plays now to try to increase their success in this regard. But if we're serious about having our own economy flourish, medical research is probably one of the best things to put a bet on, just judging by the way in which historically that has led America to be on top. And we have not really lived up to that promise for the last 10 years or so. The budget of the National Institutes of Health has been relatively flat since 2003. And if you look at what inflation has done to our buying power, we are actually down about 20% in terms of our support for medical research compared to 10 years ago. Whereas other countries like China, increasing its support for scientific research next year by 25% in 1 year. Meanwhile, we are not keeping up with the costs of doing this work. If you look at how that plays out in terms of economic growth, job creation, and so on, it is pretty clear that if we want to see our way out of the current difficulties, a dollar spent on medical research is a pretty wise investment.
That's terrific. So, Doctor, just really quickly, what are you doing at NIH to promote the highest level of scientific integrity and accountability in the conduct of science? But more importantly, how are you working to attract the next generation of doctors and scientists?
Very important questions. Certainly, we must conduct everything we do at NIH with the highest levels of integrity. We have to maintain that public trust. If we have lost that, then we've lost everything. We have very strict conflict of interest guidelines that are now applied to our scientists, both those who work in our intramural program and our grantees out there in universities, to be sure that their work is not in any way tainted by financial conflicts. If they have collaborations, for instance, with the private sector, that's fine, but that needs to be disclosed. It needs to be clear what the financial arrangements are so that no one will question whether the conclusions drawn by a scientist have been in some way influenced by something other than the facts. I think our house is very much in order in that regard. I think that's critical for public accountability. And our own sense of social responsibility has to apply to the fact that we're here to serve the public. Most scientists who work in academia or who work here at NIH are not particularly well compensated. They wouldn't go into this particular line of work if they were interested in getting rich. They're driven by a desire to make discoveries that are going to help people. That's our social responsibility. It's shared by everybody in the organization. It's one of the reasons it's such a great place to work. And I think that ethic is very much the way that we attract the next generation. Young scientists who want to make a difference, who believe in the power of science to make discoveries, and who have a mission in their own minds of wanting to make the world a better place. This is a great place to come and live out that dream. It's happening every day.
What does the future hold for the National Institutes of Health? We will ask Dr. Francis Collins, its director, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. The IBM Center for the Business of Government has recently published Governing to Win, Enhancing National Competitiveness Through New Policy and Operating Approaches, edited by Chuck Pro, which brings together insightful essays by leading thinkers and practitioners that offer a long-term strategy to improve national competitiveness. How can our nation better compete in today's global economy? And how can moving to an Enterprise USA approach in government enhance our national competitiveness? This book explores these questions and so much more. Governing to Win is available at bookstores, online booksellers, and from the publisher, RomanLittlefield.com. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Dr. Francis Collins, Director of the National Institutes of Health. So, Dr. Collins, with all the investments that we've discussed today, what are some of the steps to help ensure you are getting the value from the public dollars being put towards research?
A big part of that is how we set priorities. How do we decide when resources are not unlimited? Where should those dollars go? Because there are areas of science that look promising but don't pan out, and you want to be sure you don't keep throwing money after an idea that turned out not to be as rewarding as you thought. There are areas that maybe were extremely productive 10 years ago, but are now a little bit more sort of on automatic pilot. And maybe those are not as important as something that's rapidly emerging and where you know if you make the right investment, you're going to see serious progress in a short period of time. That's what we try to do so the public's dollars are getting the maximum benefit. And that means really surveying the landscape daily to see what fits into each of those categories and making sure you're working collectively and effectively, you know, with all the other partners that are players in this research enterprise.
And you've pointed out in our discussion today that the partnering is critical to NIH's efforts and successes. Would you tell us more about your international and interagency partnerships? How are you using collaboration to meet mission?
It's absolutely crucial. We may be the largest biomedical research funding agency in the world, but there's a lot of other partners that we depend on. Some of them are in foundations. I'll look at the progress that's been made in cystic fibrosis, for instance, a disease that my lab originally back in 1989 discovered the cause and which now has this year led to the first effective drug therapy. A long-term partnership between NIH and the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation and a company called Vertex made this possible. That's just one example. Certainly internationally, every 6 months, I go and sit down with the heads of the other international funding agencies that have the largest budgets for this sort of effort in the UK and China and India, in Japan and Germany and France and South Africa and Canada and a few others. And we try to make sure that we are working effectively together, not stepping on each other's toes, identifying areas where we could do joint projects, as we are currently doing in a new effort called the Global Alliance for Chronic Disease. In terms of interagency partnerships, I've mentioned our close interactions with FDA. Those are crucial. But we also work closely with CDC on infectious disease issues. We're working with CMS on ways to try to be sure that what they're responsible for in terms of Medicare and Medicaid is informed by the latest research, and that we are taking a tip from them about areas where they need more research in order to make wise decisions about care. We work with ARC, the Agency for Health Research Quality, on things like comparative effectiveness research. And there's a new entity called the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, which is focused specifically on identifying what works in the real world. And we at NIH have lots of partnerships there, and I serve on their board.
Dr. Collinger, a terrific spokesperson in a highly technical field. What's your strategy for explaining science to lay people? And to what extent do some of these social networking technologies assist you in this area?
I approach trying to explain science in the way that I guess I would if I was talking to my mom, because I think we scientists sometimes get all tangled up in our jargon and forget that it's probably not going to make a lot of sense to the average listener unless we put it in those terms. I also have had the privilege in a past life of being a teacher, and I think you kind of know when you're trying to get a concept across by what's the body language of your listeners, whether it's working or not, and maybe I've had enough experiences where it didn't work to recognize that. I guess maybe this also comes across a little bit. I'm excited about what science is able to do in the area of medicine right now. I enjoy sharing that excitement about igniting a spark in somebody else's eye just because there's one in mine about the ways in which we're at a unique moment in history. And to be able to tell a story about that is one of the most exciting and satisfying aspects of my job. This is an important task for all of us as scientists, and maybe one that we don't always do so well. The social networking technologies are crucial to us. We're still exploring the best ways to take full advantage of those to get the word out about why medical research is something that the average person would want to be tracking, even if they're not themselves involved in science. We're constantly looking at new ways to do that. Certainly, on our own website, if you go to NIH.gov, you will see evidences of some of the new ways we're trying to share information with people who are looking for it. And our site is one of the most heavily trafficked in all the world when it comes to people looking for medical information.
Well, Dr. Collins, as you pointed out today in our discussion, in large part to NIH-funded medical research, Americans are living longer, healthier lives. However, you also note that science has always been a marathon and not a 100-yard dash. What are some of the major opportunities and challenges your organization will face in the future, and how do you envision NIH evolving to meet those challenges and seize those opportunities?
Well, one big challenge right now is really to be sure that we are creating an environment